accession number 19661, Reel 2.
Phallus Reel 2.
Our commanding officer, John MacDonald, he had his standard answer, the problem of venereal disease, and that was 28 days confined to camp, rather similar to my punishment for being late on parade. But that was the automatic. He didn't even have to see the man. If a man was diagnosed, he was confined to camp for 28 days. Any further punishment would be at the discretion of the commanding officer. So he did try and control it. Whether, again, that had much effect, I sometimes doubt. The soldiers will go with women if they could find them.
Now, were you following the course of the Korean War?
We were, not long after I arrived. I can't remember when it was exactly. It must have been July, August time of 1950. The 27 Brigade, the Argylls and the Middlesex, were ordered to Korea. They were the first British troops to go to Korea in response to the pleas from the Americans. So, Headquarters 27 Brigade, one Argylls, one Middlesex were ordered to go at very short notice. They, like us, were way under strength. And we were all paraded one morning on the square by the commanding officer, who told us that, first of all, the Argylls were going to Korea, and secondly, that they needed volunteers from the battalion to form part of the Argylls to bring them up to strength before they went. He then said, anybody who wishes to volunteer to go with the Argylls should take one pace forward. The whole battalion, officers and men, took one pace forward. This may be an indication of the fact that living in a paddy field in a tent wasn't regarded as the best form of soldiering. In fact, 100 soldiers were selected after that. No officers, they didn't require any officers. But 100 soldiers were selected and they went off to the Argylls. So, of course, we had a vested interest in what the Argylls did in Korea. Apart from the fact, of course, we knew the war was on and we were following what was happening. And they went off, and then they, of course, were then followed from England by 29 Brigade somewhat later when they'd managed to form that. But the Argylls and Middlesex went out very poorly equipped, very under strength. They had worn out World War II vehicles, very few of which, other than the Jeeps, were four-wheel drive. They had no cold weather clothing at all, and relied, I know, the first winter they were there, entirely on charity from the Americans for warm clothing. So they went out in very rough circumstances, as compared to the 29 Brigade who followed, who of course were always referred to by them and us as the Rolls-Royce Brigade, who had everything virtually which in those days money could buy in the way of equipment and clothing.
What happened to you next?
We carried on in Hong Kong. We in fact moved our camp into slightly better accommodation. We took over camp the Argylls had had, which had a few Nissen huts and permanent buildings, and we moved into that. But apart from that, our job remained the same. We were slightly better off because this camp, or it consisted of four small camps in fact, were round a village in the territories called Fan Ling. And Fan Ling was on the main railway line from Kowloon to Canton. The trains, in fact, didn't cross the border anymore. Apparently, just after communists took over, the trains had continued running. from Kowloon through to Canton, but there was one slight snag in that the train set off in the morning with a nice locomotive and nice coaches and arrived in Canton, and when it came back next day it was pulled by something resembling Stevenson's rocket with a few cattle trucks behind it. In other words, the Chinese communists were pinching all the rolling stock, so they quickly decided that they wouldn't send the trains any further than the border after that. So that's as far as they went. And we were able, and in fact they'd introduced little two-coach rail buses running between Kowloon and Fanling, and we could get on these. It meant walking down to the station, but that was relatively easy, and we could get a train into town on a Saturday afternoon and perhaps taxi back if the trains had stopped running. So our quality of life probably improved as a result of taking over that camp.
Can you tell me about getting the call to Korea yourself, please?
Yes. I don't think we particularly expected to get it. We knew that 29 Brigade had gone to Korea, and I think, in fact, I'm sure that the intention at the time was that 29 Brigade would take over from 27 Brigade. 27 Brigade would come back to Hong Kong, and the British commitment at that time was one brigade, brigade group, which of course 29 was. It had its artillery and its armour and so on, which 27 didn't. So we weren't really expecting in that sense to go. However, on the 10th of April, the CO was at home in England. He'd been ill, he'd had dysentery, I think it was, and he'd gone home to recuperate for a short spell. On the 10th of April, we were told that we were relieving the Argylls in Korea, and that we were sailing on the 19th of April, 9 days' time, from Hong Kong. 9 days is not long to go from scratch to move a battalion complete. For example, national servicemen with less than, I think it was 3 months, but it could have been a different figure, less than 3 months to serve could not go. Anybody under a certain age couldn't go. And that various other restrictions of this sort all had to be sorted out. Equipment had to be brought up to strength. Vehicles had to be sorted out. We weren't taking many vehicles. We were taking over the Argyle's vehicles, which had been there with them since they arrived. And as I said before, they were fairly second-hand when they took them. But we had to take our jeeps with us, but that was about all. We had to take ammunition with us. All weapons had to be checked and serviced. The messes had to be closed down. Civilian clothes had to be packed up. Belongings had to be put into store. So we had 9 days to do all this. So it was a fairly busy 9 days. I was given the job, which usually went to one of the most junior subalterns, of baggage officer. It was a job that nobody wanted, because you were responsible for assembling all the baggage which was being sent, seeing it onto the transport, getting it onto the ship, and so on. So I was given this job. The ship we were going on was an American one, called the USS Montrose, which was an interesting ship. She was basically a converted, I think, victory ships, they called them. These were the mass-produced cargo ships produced on the American East Coast during the war. And it had been converted into what they called an attack transport. The conversion consisted of hanging landing craft all over it, putting some guns on it, small guns for self-defence, and providing accommodation in some of the holds for the troops and so on. And she was designed to hold, I believe, a regiment, an American regiment, which is the equivalent of our brigade, complete with its transport and stores. So it was packed solid if it was fully loaded. And the troops' accommodation, for example, was in bunks which were 6 and 8 deep in the holds. And the officers' accommodation was in bunks 4 deep in an enormous space, room, or whatever you call it. Luckily, we only had brigade headquarters and one battalion on it, so we weren't quite so crowded. The other interesting thing about it was that it was manned by the United States Navy Naval Reserve. It was one of the first ships that they'd been given entirely for themselves. Obviously, the Americans had called up a lot of their reserves for the Korean War, but they'd been integrated into their ships' crews and so on. But this was the first ship, apart from the commanding officer, which was completely manned by naval reservists. So they were a very mixed bunch of people, both lower deck and officers. Officers were people like accountants and estate agents and people of this sort who had sometimes served in the American Navy. So they were quite an interesting bunch. So this was a new experience, certainly for us, added to by the fact that the ship was dry because it was American Navy. And I shall always remember, as we went up the gangplank, there was a large sign which said, "No alcohol will be brought on board this ship without permission of the ship's medical officer," which was slightly embarrassing because every officer, as he climbed the gangplank, had at least 2 bottles of spirits in his pack. The reason for this was that, as I mentioned before, we had to close the messes down, and the mess had quite a large stock. We couldn't drink it, which would have been one way of getting rid of it. So they said, well, if anybody wants to take stuff with them to Korea, say how much you want, and obviously we all did, not knowing that we were going on a dry ship. So we all climbed on board, and of course we didn't say anything, and took our drink with us. And this led to a slightly amusing incident on the ship. It was a 4-day trip from Hong Kong to Korea. And we were invited to join the ship's officers in the wardroom, as there was only the one battalion and brigade headquarters. And in the wardroom, there was a constant supply of coffee, being an American ship and being dry. And I always remember the coffee pots. They were beautiful, tall, stainless steel, rather elegant coffee pots. Must have held a good litre of coffee, I think. And this was always hot on the side. And we used to go down and enjoy this. But one evening we were a bit fed up. And somebody suggested that if we took one of these coffee pots away and filled it with a couple of bottles of whiskey, we could bring it down to the wardroom, get ourselves some coffee cups out on the table, and we could happily sit and chat and do whatever we wanted to do and drink our whiskey in comfort. Which we decided to do. And we were minding our own business, doing this quite happily, when an officer came off watch and walked into the wardroom. They were very hospitable, the Americans. They had done everything they could to make us welcome on that ship. And really went out of their way to try and make us feel at home. So this character walked into the wardroom and he looked at us drinking out of our teacups or coffee cups and saw this pale brown liquid in our cups and said, "Say, you fellas drinking tea?" So we said, yes, we were, cold tea actually. Would he fancy a cup? Well, you could see that the last thing he could ever think of drinking was a cup of cold tea. But being hospitable and having perhaps been told by the commanding officer that they must humour these strange people that they had on board, he said, "Gee, I'd just love a cup of cold tea." So we passed him a cup and he took a tentative sip of it. And having taken a tentative sip of it, he drained the cup and said, "Gee, that sure was a good cup of cold tea," and held out his cup for another. Well, somehow word got round that cold tea was being drunk in the wardroom, and more American officers arrived, and we very soon got through quite a lot of whiskey, and we, who were used to drinking it, were quite happy, and some of the Americans who were less used to drinking it were even happier. And the party closed down, and we thought about it and thought, there's going to be a problem here, I can see. Anyway, next morning we all went in to breakfast, and there were some very hungover American officers sitting around trying to eat their pancakes and syrup, and we were enjoying our breakfast, and the captain walked in, and he stood in the doorway, looked down at his officers and looked at us, and we thought, here it comes. And in his best southern accent he said, "Here, you fellows had a tea party last night." We never heard another word. So that was the United States Naval Reserve, and perhaps a very good regular United States Naval captain.
Did this tea drinking have any deleterious effect on the handling of the ship?
Didn't appear to have. Didn't appear to have. Maybe the captain stayed on the bridge.
Where did you disembark?
We disembarked in Incheon, which, of course, the previous year had been the site of the American Marine landing. You couldn't, in fact, go into Incheon. You had to anchor off because they knocked hell out of the port facilities. In fact, they knocked hell out of Incheon, I think. There wasn't much of it left. So we anchored off Incheon, and they put the landing craft in the water, and we started sorting out the ship and the soldiers to take them ashore. And the plan was that we would stay in Incheon for 48 hours while I, as a baggage officer, unloaded the ship, which had been loaded non-tactically, because this was the plan, that we had 48 hours to unload. So the battalion would stay there 48 hours, shake itself out, collect its equipment as it came off the ship, and we would then take over from the Argylls. I hadn't been working long when I noticed a launch come alongside, and the strange sight of a British officer in service dress, red band round his hat, red tabs, came up the gangway and disappeared into the ship. And half an hour later, he departed. And immediately the commanding officer summoned all the officers and said that this was, I think it was General Robertson, who commanded all the British troops in the far, in that theatre, in Japan and so on. And the date was the 23rd of April, which of course is a famous date. And General Robertson had told the commanding officer that the Chinese had launched spring offensive, and that in fact the Argylls and the Middlesex 27th Brigade, who were at Cap Yong with the 6th Republic of Korean Division, were in trouble, and that we weren't going to spend 48 hours in Incheon. We were to move up that night to Cap Yong to reinforce 27th Brigade. This presented the problem that, of course, the soldiers had their rifles and they had 50 rounds of ammunition, but most of the other weapons, the machine guns, the mortars, and the vehicles were loaded in the ship. I was told to get off the ship whatever I could, but that we would leave with whatever I got off, and that the rest would follow in due course. The result was that we went from Incheon with one Bren gun per platoon instead of three. I think we had two machine guns in the battalion. I don't think we had any mortars. And I think we had three jeeps. We had still only our 50 rounds of ammunition per man. And off we went. Into a holding area at Cap Yong. The other thing which we were short of was maps. And I believe we started with two, at that time, with two sets of maps. One held by the commanding officer, and one held by the intelligence officer. So there we were, ill-equipped. We didn't know where we were. The commanding officer probably did, but nobody else did. And it rained. And I think that is probably the thing I remember more than anything else. It's the thing I remember more than anything else about our first week there, was that it rained. Sometimes heavily, sometimes less heavily. Sometimes it was perhaps more low cloud and thick mist, but it was always wet. And of course, we were not dressed for Korea in April, because again, we were still wearing tropical kit from Hong Kong, with the addition of a woolen pullover. So we were also, apart from being wet, we were also cold. We took over from the Argyles there eventually. It's slightly difficult to remember the chronological order of things. I remember the handover from the Argyles. It must have been one of the quickest handovers in the history of the British Army. We were all in an like area.
His father and my...
One would say a sort of large open space, a large bit of open land, with the companies dotted round and battalion headquarters. And the Argyles drove in from one side and parked a row of vehicles, very dubious quality vehicles. I remember one Bedford three-tonner which had painted in large white letters on its tailboard, "No Brakes," which gave an idea of the quality, I think. And also their carriers, their trapped carriers, which the mortars used and the machine guns used, they were always a problem, and the ones that they brought with them didn't look much better. But they drove in all these vehicles. They disembarked from their vehicles. A squad of men formed up to one side, who we then discovered were the ones who were being left behind for us. They were ones like the ones we'd left in Hong Kong. They were leaving behind because they hadn't been in Korea long enough. They weren't going home. So they were formed up on one side. The rest of the battalion got into some American trucks on the other side of the field and departed. And that was the handover. So we got this large draft of Argyles, who were then parceled out to the various companies to help to bring us up to strength, remembering that we'd left Hong Kong at a very low strength. So here we collected a few more. And we got our vehicles, such as they were. So that was the handover from the Argyles. I think there was a handover of COs, but of course that was way above the heads of the likes of myself, who were down at the basic level in the battalion. We then, at some stage, got a draft of reinforcements from Japan. And that was also interesting because the reinforcements had come out from England to the reinforcement depot in Japan for the battalions currently in Korea. So they didn't include any KOSB. They included people from every regiment in the Highland Brigade, who were reinforcements to the Argyles, and they included representatives of everybody in the Home Counties Brigade, who were reinforcements to the Middlesex. But now they were KOSB, and the company was brought roughly up to strength. And my company commander said, we will have a roll call. And I think we found that in a company of around 100 men, 13 different British regiments were represented at that point in time. There was even the odd Irishman amongst them, I know, who was, should have been a reinforcement for 29 Brigade, but somehow found his way to us. So that made an interesting collection, and I remember the company commander saying to them that he realised that regimental loyalty would be a very difficult problem at first, so all he wanted and all he asked of them was to be loyal to a company, which was the finest company in the British Army. It didn't matter what regiment was, it was a company, they were part of it, and he was the company commander. And it worked. They soon all settled down, they all worked together, and they did in fact become a very effective company. And a number of them, certainly of the regulars, did in fact transfer to the regiment and remained with us ever after. National service, and of course, went their way in due course.
And you were platoon commander?
I, at that time, was the commander of number 2 platoon, A Company, yes.
And you had just as big a variety in that platoon?
I did. My platoon sergeant, in fact, was a Royal Scot who had been a prisoner in Korea during the Second World War, having been taken prisoner in Hong Kong. And I certainly had a number of Home Counties regiment, Cockneys, all sorts of people of that description, who were quite foreign to the Jocks, who were the other half. And of course I had Black Watch, I had all sorts of Highlanders, one sort and another. And of course, one of the Highlanders who came to us on that occasion was Speakman, who came to us from the Black Watch. And he was part of that draft of reinforcements. And of course, he subsequently was one of those who transferred to the regiment.
And your platoon?
No, he was in another company.
What? How did they all get on with each other in your platoon?
Very well indeed. I suppose it was one's job to make sure they did. I mean, it was the job of the platoon commander, really. He was the head of the family, and it was his job to make the family a cohesive working organisation. It certainly seemed to work. But then I think the British soldier had always proved this. I mean, it happened, it wasn't unique. It had happened time and time again in the last war.
So what specifically do you have to do to make sure they do get on with each other?